Hello and welcome to another episode of the Motown Megacast. I'm one of your three hosts, and two-thirds of us right now have Spencer Turnbull throwing a heater right now on our phones. He is currently, he hasn't given up a hit. I believe he has one walk and five Ks. He's dealing right now.
Now, you weren't supposed to mention that. You never mention the no-hitter or the perfect game unless you're facing the team. So thanks for ruining it.
I just said he was throwing a heater. You brought in the perfect game. But I was just saying he's throwing a heater ball. I just happened to mention that he just had one hit or he had no hit. So if that's on you, well, let's get right started. Let's actually get started with Tigers. I wanted to start with Red Wings, but now that we're talking to the Tigers, let's just hop right into it. Paul, give us a little talk while we're watching them deal.
Well, right now the Tigers have won six of their last eight games. They are 15-26 and fourth place in the AL Central. Now, here is the exciting news. That doesn't usually sound exciting. You're 11 games below 500 through 41 games played. You're in fourth place. Doesn't really sound that great. But considering where the Tigers were at 9-24, they were on pace to be one of the worst teams in MLB history, potentially the worst team in MLB history. Now they're not even in last place in their own division. They're ahead of the Twins. Their offense is getting hot. The Tigers are hot right now. Now, I don't expect this to continue. I don't expect them to make a playoff run or anything. But at least they're not complete garbage. Like, there is some optimism with this team. They have an outside shot of getting 70 wins. I don't think it's going to happen. But it could. It could. They could go like 70-92. They have a couple of new guys. They got Haas. He's been up for a couple of games. He had a couple home runs last night in Seattle. And then they got this guy, Rogers, who's got that nice mustache. He's also hit a few home runs. And the people that have been hitting poorly, like Miggy and Jacoby Jones, aren't hitting as poorly now. Their averages aren't like, oh my God, you should be in single A. It's like, it's not great at all, but it's much better. So I look for the Tigers to continue the success and continue to be around the third to last place range in the AL Central.
So here's the thing. I always feel like I'm the negative fan. I'm going to come here again and do it again. Here's the problem with the Tigers kind of rebounding. And if they end up with like a 70 win season, something like obviously terrible, but not as bad as they were on track for, that just gives Alavila another reason to stay. And I would rather the team lose every remaining game than he stay. It's sitting in the back of my mind, and it sucks because I want to just watch Casey Mize deal and have an amazing night. Like when he pitched 7 1/3 innings, he looked great. He looked like the number one overall pick. But in the back of my mind, I just have it sitting that he might be dealing, that kind of dealing, those kind of performances might be backing up someone like Alavila to stay. And I get that's kind of a crappy thing to do, like kind of raining on everyone's parade because Casey Mize is looking good. I mean, heck, we're watching Turnbull right now. Spencer Turnbull, Matthew Boyd's having a decent year. A lot of the pitching, Jose Urena, after having kind of a rough start, is kind of, you know, he's still a bit rocky, but he's put it together.
Fulmer too.
Fulmer, yeah. Fulmer's had like a nice little comeback story. There are a lot of fun storylines with the Tigers. Akil Baidoo. It's all with the background of Alavila, so it's really hard for me to get excited about the team.
I'll put it this way. If the Tigers get over 70 wins, I want Alavila to stay. He's shown that he can put up a decent starting rotation and some good prospects in the minors. Now, they need to produce that, though. I don't think they're going to produce that winning record. But if he goes into next season with that type of cap space and that much talent already on the team, he's shown that he knows what he's doing. But he hasn't shown it yet.
So what we have right now is Matthew Boyd, a guy who probably should have been traded a couple of years ago, is having a nice season, and this is probably close to his peak. He's probably going to be, you know, peaking this year, next couple of years. He's playing at a level where he can be someone's ace. the really good picks you're talking about, the guys who were they were number one overall picks. A lot of these guys were not diamonds in the rough. When you're a good GM in baseball, you have to find diamonds in the rough, and he has not shown an ability to do that. I don't find picking Casey Mize to be impressive. That was a consensus number one overall pick. So I think you cannot argue prospects with him. Every prospect that's good he has was picked in the top 10. Every good prospect he has was handpicked. Like, it wasn't this guy. He's pounding the table for his guy. He's going out and he's getting the best guy available. And that's a good strategy. But also, you're just getting rewarded for being a terrible team. And I question his willingness to spend money. That's another thing, too. You say they have all this cap space. They have money. Who says they're actually going to spend anything on it? That's what worries me, because I don't see him spending any money. He hasn't done in the past. And if you're saying he's fielding a good pitching staff, I don't even think that's him. He decided not to trade Matthew Boyd. We're having a nice little turnaround from Fulmer. He's injured, though. He had Tommy John surgery. I don't know how much longer he can last. Jose Arena was a good pickup in free agency. I will say that. But there's a lot of things about this. I don't think he fielded a good starting rotation. I think he kind of fell into it. I cannot get behind. If they go back and win 80 games this year, I do not, unless it's because they call up a bunch of little picks he had throughout the year, there is no reason why Al Avila should ever return to the Tigers. He is one of the worst general managers in all of sports. He's garbage. He can't field the team. He's a cheapskate, and he's ruined this organization. It was the worst possible pick you could have had to lead the rebuild. I completely disagree with you. That is insane, Paul. He is garbage.
If the Tigers win 80 games with this roster, that's
AJ Hinch, though.
I mean, that is AJ Hinch. But come on. That would be a miracle. And that's part of Al Avila. I mean, he got the roster together. All AJ Hinch is doing is making them play well. And you'll see on the trade deadline what type of team Al Avila is looking at. Is he looking at the future, or is he going back to, we need to rebuild again? If he goes back to, we need to rebuild again, he should be fired at the end of the trade deadline. If he trades away Matthew Boyd, he should be fired. I know that's a minority opinion. Matthew Boyd has several years left in his tank. He's now just starting to get into his prime. That's how prospects in baseball work. They take several years to develop in many cases. Look at Verlander. He wasn't amazing when he started. I mean, he wasn't bad. He was on the 06 World Series team. But he took years to develop into that Cy Young type of pitcher. Then he struggled. And then he won the Cy Young with Houston, several years after he won his original Cy Young. This is very common. I would hate to see Boyd get traded. Like many of the greats, like Verlander and JD Martinez, he cannot continue to go down this path.
So a couple of things. I like how you built a scarecrow to my argument immediately when you said that the 90-win team or the 80-win team. I said that exaggerating. Obviously, I think that's completely unreasonable. So let's cut that crap out there. You know that's not true. And that was a lot of fancy talk about Verlander, you know, being really good. And I understand the fact, Paul, I know you know baseball better than me, but I understand the fact that baseball prospects need to develop. I understand this. But the fact of the matter is that Boyd has done this multiple times. He's looked great at the beginning of the season. After the trade deadline, he looks like a different player. I don't know what it is, but it's consistently happened, and that's what I'm worried about. Every year after year, he starts off with like a sub-4 ERA, and then after the trade deadline, they miss the opportunity to go and get assets, even when they were rebuilding. I just don't understand. This year, you can make an argument for it, because if you're assuming, so you're using your logical framework, I understand where you're coming from. If you think Al Avila should go out and field a competent team like next year, then what you're saying makes sense. Matthew Boyd should not be dealt. I will agree with you there, but I don't know if this roster is good enough. I think they have a good starting rotation foundationally, but look at their hitting. They don't even have hitters down the row. Like, you have Torkelson, you have Paredes, you have guys like way, way, way down, but it's baseball. And you know baseball better than me. You know the fact that prospects don't always hit. So your best prospects are low single A right now. They're in single A. You've got to get a bunch of guys way down on the list, and I don't think that putting together a decent starting rotation is good enough to keep someone's job, even if it powers you to 70 wins this year.
To me, it's all about the trade deadline and really preseason before next year. What he does at the winter meetings, assuming the Tigers are in that 65 to 70 win range, they cannot be what they were the last 3-4 seasons. They cannot be one of the worst teams in baseball. They have to finish ahead of Minnesota. They have to be competing with Kansas City. You know, they cannot be in dead last. If they are, Al Avila needs to go. If the team is building up, if they're on an uptrend, and then Avila's willing to spend, which he can spend a lot of money, get three big guys, that can hit or pitch, I don't really care what they do, then he will show that he wants to make the playoffs within the next couple of years, which they obviously could. I mean, it doesn't take a lot.
Yeah, but I'm not chasing playoffs. I'm chasing pennants here. And that's the problem with Al Avila, is that we've let him rebuild for 4 years now, and he's just done nothing. You look at teams like the White Sox and even Kansas City this year, where, you know, certain teams are kind of on their way up a bit. The record may not show it, Paul, because I know that's all you look at. But in terms of individual performances, teams are starting to look up, and you just don't see that with the Tigers. Like, you see some people look, you know, you see Casey Mize, he's starting to come into his own, but I don't really see any hope on the horizon for this team. I still don't, and I think thinking that going out and spending $40 million on a solid shortstop is going to solve all of Detroit's problems, I think that's a silly way to look at it. This is not the Yankees. We're not going to spend our way out of this. I don't know. I think that's a bit done. It's obvious you and I have different philosophies with this, so we'll just move on. I don't think there's any point. Ryan, anything to add there?
Yeah, I kind of just wanted to talk a little bit about, like, the Boyd being traded prospect. So for me personally, I kind of feel like it just has to be, like, a situational type of decision. Because, I don't know, I don't think Matthew Boyd, it's unlikely he'll ever move the needle, right? But it's also obvious that he can be quite a good complement to a starting rotation. So I kind of think it just, you know, obviously he's not going to be on the same timeline as your Casey Mize and, like, younger just prospect. But, you know, I think you have to be able to walk the line between, I guess, like, talent identification and just, I guess, proper value for players, like valuing players properly. Like, if you get a good offer for Matthew Boyd, then, you know, you can take it. You can get a young prospect or something for a team that maybe is in more of a win now situation, wants to shore up their rotation. So I think it's just going to depend on how he's performing at the deadline and what other teams need and what other teams are willing to give.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I agree there, I'd say. It's kind of like, kind of like what Steve Yzerman did with Anthony Mantha this year. Obviously, situation is different, but he wasn't looking to trade Anthony Mantha. It's just, if the deal comes along, that's what it is. And if a deal comes along with Boyd, I don't think they should pass it up. I really don't. Like, I like Boyd. He's been one of the most fun Tigers to watch this year. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely clouding my judgment a bit because, like I said, him and Casey Mize and Akil Baidu at the beginning of the season has been the reason I've tuned into games. So, I mean, I love the guy, but I don't see him appreciating in value. And like I said, I obviously have a different scope of where this team is going to go in the future than Paul does, or you know, people with more optimistic futures of where this team can go. So I don't know that us keeping him is optimizing his value if it's going to go nowhere. If we're a team stuck in middling for the next 2-3 years, I just don't see the point in keeping Boyd.
I mean, I'd be in favor of trading Boyd if they could get, like, a Casey Mize type of prospect or an actual, like, player that has 4 or 5 years on their contract for whatever reason, maybe a bat that isn't that talented. Because you don't see that. You don't see teams that are rebuilding actually trade for a player. Why would you do that? Well, if you're trading actual player as well, then that isn't that bad. But we all know what's going to happen if the Tigers trade Matthew Boyd. They're probably going to get a couple of shortstop prospects. That they're a dime a dozen. That's literally what's going to happen. And that's why I'd be so upset with it, because I know they're not going to get a good deal.
Isn't that a poor reflection of Al Avila? The fact that you're worried that he's going to get a shortstop, because in every single trade he's made, he's traded away your heroes for scraps, trades away Verlander for scraps, trades away all of the players for scraps. Is that not an indictment of the general manager, Ball?
You'd be surprised of how many rebuilding GMs do this. I don't know why. It seems like they know what they're talking about, but it's like, huh, you know, I could get this great pitcher prospect, or I could get a couple of shortstops and a third baseman and a player to be named later. I'll take that one. I don't get it, but whatever. We'll see what happens at the trade deadline. You'll hear more of my opinion then.
And let's hope for our sake as fans that maybe Avila can string together maybe a few like solid events or solid decisions in a row, and I don't know. If not secure, not even necessarily securing his like spot, I guess, as the GM, but like, you know, if his time is coming to an end, maybe we can leave on a good note.
Yeah, secure a couple of deals, because it would just suck to see, like you were saying, Paul, I'm someone who advocates for Boyd being traded, but if they seriously sent him away for middling prospects who can't make it out of AA, I just... It's going to be so hard to watch this team in good faith. It's just, it's already hard. And, you know, if he starts trading away the people that make this team watchable for scraps again, it's going to be hard to tune in.
I would like to mention that the Tigers are very hesitant to fire Avila because he's been with the organization for a very long time. He was Dave Dombrowski's assistant manager since 2003. I believe is when he started there. He was Dombrowski's manager for about 12, 13 years until about 15, 16 when Avila took over, and he's been the GM ever since. So he's almost two decades in to being with the Tigers organization. He was under the old Ilitch that everybody knows and loves. He has seen the Tigers go to multiple World Series. And I know Dave Dombrowski has no personality, but he did bring two AL pennants to the Tigers, and he won the World Series when he went over to Boston. So maybe Avila knows what he's talking about. I know Dombrowski knows how to rebuild the team. I just hope Avila has the right mindset and we're all just stupid.
No, I don't think you can make the argument that just because he's part of the organization. I mean, I always bring it to the Red Wings because that's the team I know best. But what you're arguing right now is a perfect example of Ken Holland. Ken Holland was with the team since the mid-80s. He was part of the 1989 draft that saw players like Lidstrom fielded and Sergei Fedorov and Vladimir Konstantinov in the 1989 draft. Like he was the head of scouting for so many years. He came in. He was, you know, he was heralded to be the future of the race. He was gonna keep them in the greatness. And his moves led to our destruction. I don't think that you can argue because he's been a part of the organization that it means it's magically going to work out. I get what you're saying, why they're hesitant to fire him, though. That makes sense because for the Ilitches especially, loyalty is pretty important. And I think that's why it took them so long to get rid of Holland. And I think that's why it's taking so long to get rid of Avila. Because, you know, I went on a little rant about Avila there. But I think he's a good enough guy. Like, I have no problem with him personally, and I'm sure he's a great guy, but I don't want him managing my baseball team. They have made them nearly unwatchable. So let's move on from the Tigers. We yelled long enough from the Tigers. Anything else, Ryan?
Just a quick little update. Through almost seven innings, Spencer Turnbull still has a no-hitter.
Are you serious?
He still has not given up a hit, I should say. I didn't mention the first part.
Yeah, no.
He has not given up a hit to this point. So.
Oh, my God. Well, okay. Please keep us tracked.
Yeah, so this is just something we'll be kind of just keeping an eye on.
The game. Oh, my God. If he throws a no-hitter during the episode, I will freak out. All right. So let's get on to the Red Wings then. The biggest news with the Red Wings, Jeff Blashill got an extension. He's been the head coach for 4 years now. He has a losing record. He's never been to the playoffs, and they extended him. In a vacuum, that is a pretty terrible decision. If you just look at it objectively, I mean, extending a coach who has not been to the playoffs and has a losing record and has consistently fielded one of the worst teams in hockey, you know, that's not a great look, but I think circumstances are important for Blashill. And like I was talking about a few minutes ago with Ken Holland really destroyed this team and made it the shell of an NHL team. Like, that, this needed a deep rebuild, and I think it's unfair to judge Blashill based on his past performances. Now, I do have gripes with some of the things he does. This year, benching Evgeny Svechnikov and giving him barely any ice time for not really any good reason, and trying to turn players into two-way players when they don't really need it. Like, just let a score sometimes. I mean, it was the same thing with Mantha. I think Mantha, under his system, a lot of the time was kind of just not fitting in because of the way he coaches. But at the same time, we've seen development this year, too, especially this year. The team has a better record. They didn't finish last in their division. They finished seventh, right above the Columbus Blue Jackets. And a lot of players took a step forward. Philip Zadina, he took a big step forward this year. Not statistically. If you look at statistics, he has less goals in more games. But that's because his shooting percentage was 6.5, and his career average is 13. So he was literally, his shooting percentage was cut in half. But he just looked like a two-way player. Like, it's so stereotypical to say that. It's such like a hockey term, but he's really starting to develop into that two-way player who can make a difference no matter where he is on the ice. He's not just a dangerous goal scorer. He can do other things. So that's a big development I've seen, and I think that has a lot to do with Blashill's system. And another person is Michael Rasmussen, picked ninth overall in 2017, I believe it was, by Ken Holland. Everyone thought it was a reach at the time. It kind of was, and he's kind of had a rough trajectory. But this year, it looks like he's finally stuck. he's really improved his skating. He doesn't look like a solid top six winger, but you put him on like that grind line who just goes out there to shut down an opposing. That's exactly what you want. So I don't know. There's a couple of rookies a couple of younger guys, I should say, who are kind of developing well under Blashill. And like I said, I have problems with some of the way he deploys things. He doesn't understand how to run a power play. His offensive scheme, where it's dump and chase hockey, is not great. But we also need to consider that this team has been one of the least talented in the NHL for years now. And that's not his fault. I think that's management's fault. And the details of the contract have not been released yet, but it's probably a two-year gap contract, and that's exactly what I want. I'll change my tune if it's a 4 or 6 year contract. I'll start freaking out. But if it's just a bridge contract, see what he does with a better squad. He already showed he can improve the team a bit this year. The underlying metrics may say otherwise, but you know, on the ice, results are results, and this team was better than last year in less games. So him coming back, I understand the frustration of the fan base. I'm just trying to calm us all down here. He's not as bad as you think. Give him 2 years. If the team regresses next year, fire him early. You know, if they look about the same or a little better, keep him. And then if in that second year, when the team's on the upswing, if he's still kind of middling, get rid of him then. But give him 2 years to actually field a competent team. Did you want to say something, Paul?
So we have Steve Yzerman as the GM in Detroit. Through two seasons, they haven't made the playoffs, which is expected. I don't think we do want to see one, but we're not going to get a Stanley Cup with the Red Wings organization, not this quickly. But how many years are you going to give Yzerman to at least get the Red Wings into, like, say, the second round of the playoffs? I'm not talking about the Stanley Cup, but at least get them competitive.
I'd say within, so not counting this year, the next two seasons, they will miss the playoffs. I think after that, they get in. So the problem is with this year, so with Red Wings fans, we all kind of know that the team lacks elite talent really bad. This team really needs high-end talent. Like, I'm not talking necessarily Connor McDavid or, you know, Austin Matthews, but one of those top-line centers, a game changer, someone you can kind of build around. And that's why I think the next 2 years, you know, conspiracy theory on, he might have kept Blashill specifically to keep the team kind of lower. I don't know. Because in the next couple drafts, we have guys like Shane Wright and Connor Bedard. In the 2022 and 2023, both look like top-end Austin Matthews-type guys already. They're putting up insane numbers in juniors at just like 16 and 17 years old. So the 2022 and 2023 drafts look loaded. And all the Red Wings at this point need, we have so many good prospects in the pool. I honestly think the LA Kings and what's the other team out west that gets – there's another team out west that gets so much love for their prospect pool. But I think the Red Wings have one of the best in the league. It's so deep at almost every position except for center that I think just a couple of high-end talents, that's what it needs. And I think they should probably not be good the next 2 years so we can have a chance at the high-end talent. But to answer your question, Paul, I'm going to give it 2 years. I think they still need some high-end talent, but you have guys like Moritz Seider coming through. He won Best Defenseman of the Year. And then speaking of the draft, actually, I want to bring up the Red Wings did lock up the sixth best odds in the draft. That means they have a 15.3% chance to finish in the top two and a 7.5% chance to get number one. But to Red Wings fans and Detroit fans in general, those numbers don't matter because they just won't finish in the top three. It just won't happen. That's just – we've come to realize that as Detroit fans, that those lottery balls don't usually fall our way, whether you're a more Pistons guy or you're a Red Wings guy. It just doesn't happen. So I don't put too much stock into that, especially this year. I'm sure I'll go into what prospects I like in the future a bit more, but it's looking like there's a gap between seven and the rest, kind of like in the NFL this year. There was kind of those top seven, top eight guys who were seen as blue chip, and the rest were kind of at a different level. Still high-end talent, but not necessarily at the same like blue chip level, and I think you're kind of seeing that in the NHL this year, so I'll get into that a bit later, but for now, six best odds, they'll probably drop like three or four spots because that's just what happens in Detroit. But that's all I got for the Red Wings today. You want to go hit those Pistons there, Ryan?
Yeah, so speaking of draft lottery odds and securing positions, the Detroit Pistons just finally put the bow on their long, grueling, yet fun 2020-2021 season. So I think the last game was just very indicative of how the rebuild has gone so far, where they were kind of in a position where they really did need to lose that game to just secure lottery odds. So they secured the second worst record, so now they now have approximately a 14% chance for the number one overall pick. I think it's a 52% chance for top four, and in the draft that the player pool, I think top four is kind of, I don't want to say necessary because you know you can find talent at any spot, but it kind of seems like if falling out of the top four would just be just a not great situation. But yeah, so it's going to be really interesting. I believe it's June 22nd is the NBA draft lottery. So the nice thing is the lowest they can fall is six. So they can't go any lower than six, which is, I think it's the highest draft pick they've had, or of their own draft pick since like 1994. Just based on the odds, or based on the odds right now. So yeah, it's gonna be really interesting to see if they can finally get some luck in the lottery. Hopefully, move up. They have never ever moved up in the lottery. They have had 18 times they've been in the lottery since this system was established. They have never ever moved up.
Good Lord. I believe that's the numbers. Oh my yep. God. So
every time they either stay at their spot or go down.
How is that even possible?
I don't know. It's, but you know, you talk about these Detroit sports lottery luck. I mean, it's a real thing. So let's hope that Troy Weaver can, you know,
wheel some magic into there.
Yeah. Oh my I don't God. Know. He's done some magic so far. Let's see if he can kind of keep it up.
Right now, who are you looking at for each position, each draft position, 1 through 4.
Okay, so there's not going to be a whole lot of hot takes because there's a lot of kind of consensus in within like just the draft nicks and where people are being mocked. So number one overall, Cade Cunningham. I don't even have to say too much about him. You know, he's just a game changer right off the bat. He's like a 6'8 point guard who doesn't have a single hole in his game. He is just as comfortable passing and distributing as he is creating a shot for himself. And he projects as a plus defender in the NBA just because of his size and the position he plays versus his measurables. So he'd be able to create a lot of havoc. And yeah, he's just one of those guys who just accelerates the rebuild. And the presence of Cade Cunningham on next year's Pistons likely leads to a play-in
tournament. I was going to say that fringe spot, isn't it?
Yeah.
I honestly see that.
I guess I can't declare that definitively, obviously, but I really do believe that with a summer of development, like, you know, an entire summer, which the prospects didn't have because of the COVID-riddled offseason. So Killian Hayes, Sadiq Bey, Isaiah Stewart, they're all going to have an entire summer. Obviously, Jeremy Grant's going to continue to kind of fall into this newfound, like, main primary scorer role. And, yeah, so first overall, Cade Cunningham every single time. I don't care what anybody else says. You don't pick anybody else over him.
No, and you're right. That would just immediately kick the team in the next gear. Mm-hmm. It would advance the rebuild so quick because you get that elite talent just like that.
Yeah, and that just opens up everything because then, you know, you can kind of – at that point, you can maybe spend some money in free agency and get kind of round out with, you know, some shooters or some – I don't know, valuable bench pieces.
Just some vets.
Yeah, some guidance, players that you can kind of fill out the roster with because you kind of have that main core down.
Yeah, and we've seen this with the last few number one picks. They haven't completely taken their teams to the postseason, but look at Zion and New Orleans. They are close to making the postseason. And then you have LaMelo or LiAngelo?
LaMelo.
Yeah, with Charlotte. They just got knocked out today against Indianapolis in that play-in game. So, those two number one picks with very little time are getting those teams up to postseason-ish areas, and I think Cade Cunningham can do that with the Pistons, but I wouldn't expect anything higher than like the 7 through 10 range.
Yeah, I agree. I don't necessarily think that they would really be able to field like an actual competitive team next year because at that point, like the roster construction just isn't finished yet. You know, it's still a work in progress. But anyways, let me continue on because I forgot we were talking about prospects or top four. So at the number two overall pick, this is the next consensus, which is Evan Mobley
out of USC. Oh, yeah, USC guy.
So, yep, so Evan Mobley is a 7 foot tall. He's basically a modern day NBA wing in a 7 foot body. And so with Evan Mobley, you get elite rim running, rim protection. He's a crazy athlete. He's shown he can put the ball on the floor even. And he's just one of those prospects that they label like, you know, a unicorn. One of those guys who just, you don't see guys like him very often. You don't see guys with the physical abilities that he has in his body. So Evan Mobley, The question that I guess that one kind of raises is, what do you do about Isaiah Stewart? Do you move him to the four, or do you try Plumlee, or not Plumlee? Do you try Mobley at the four, or do you just have Isaiah Stewart come off the bench and be an energy guy? I don't think that's gonna happen. I think that Isaiah Stewart is gonna be in the starting lineup next year, but
But yeah, personally, I do think that Mobley and Stewart could play together. I think if Stewart needs to, he can play the four. I think he's athletic enough to defend the four, and he's shown he can put the ball on the floor maybe a little bit. I mean that's going to be a work in progress skill. But yeah, he's shown that he I don't think he's limited to a center position based on his abilities on the court. So I really do think that they could slot in together and just be a nasty front court duo. So after Mobley, this is where you get a little bit more of the, you know, there's not necessarily a consensus guy. I think for most people that are focusing on the Pistons rebuild, I think, so Jalen Green next would be kind of close to, the next closest thing to a consensus pick there. So Jalen Green actually played on the G League Ignite team. So he has a year of professional basketball under his wing. And essentially, he would fit the role that they kind of need that isn't necessarily going to be like a Cade Cunningham superstar potential type. I guess I don't even want to say he doesn't have superstar potential. But he kind of fits the mold of, like, you know, they need, I think Dwayne Casey was saying, now we need scoring, shooting, and finishing. And Jalen Green gives you all those. He's just a pure scorer. He's a crazy athlete. He is just insanely fast with the ball in his hand. And, but yeah, I think he is kind of like what the Pistons need. He's the next best thing, outside of like I was saying, like a guy like Cade Cunningham really can just, fit into any scheme easily. But I think Jalen Green is like the best fit that isn't one of those all around, seamless fit guys. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. But yeah, I would still be thrilled with Jalen Green. I think that he could elevate some of the guys around him, and he could provide some of that scoring. Cause early signs are, inspiring, but you know, we don't really know if Sadiq Bey is going to be able to turn into a go-to option. I mean, I like to think that he'll be able to, but he could find a role as just like a 3-and-D type player instead. And then I guess so this fourth one I'm just going to talk about really quickly. So the next guy to kind of round out the top four is generally Jalen Suggs, and you probably recognize him from the NCAA tournament run that Gonzaga had. He was the star player on essentially the best team in the country for most of the season. So he's more of a lead guard, but he doesn't really, it's not the same way Cade Cunningham kind of would come in, and I don't know. I don't think necessarily he needs to have the ball in his hands the way Cade Cunningham does. And honestly, Cade Cunningham can probably play off ball and be great as well. But with a guy like that, you just want the ball in their hands. But I think Jalen Suggs is, he is a lead guard, and I think that's what he does best. But you could probably try to experiment because, you know, he's a bigger guy. He's 6'5". He could play some combo guard maybe. Kind of, I think it would be really interesting if the Pistons got one of these, like, lead guard guys and kind of transform their backcourt into, like, a dual point guard type where, like, either guy can be handling the ball, can be initiating the offense. And I think if you get a guy like Suggs or Cunningham that you can pair with Killian Hayes, I think that could just be a very cool backcourt dynamic. So yeah, it's Suggs is definitely my lowest of those four because I would prefer, if they're getting a lead ball handler guy, I would want it to be Cade Cunningham. Otherwise, I would kind of want Killian Hayes to just take over those duties in the future, kind of. But so yeah, those are my top four. I think any one of those guys is definitely the type of prospect that would just continue this rebuild on the trajectory that it's at. So that's what I got for my top four.
All right, sweet. So yeah, like you said, a lot depends on this lottery. It's just like it can speed up that rebuild so quickly if you get the right guys. And you can say that with anyone, but you see in so many sports where they're like, teams just get lucky in the draft and you, like they just bump up that many times and you see how quickly it changes their trajectory. The New York Rangers, they got that number one spot and got Alexi Lafreniere last year. They bumped up like 13 spots. You just see stuff like that happen. It's just it's a franchise altering. It's crazy how much those lottery odds can alter a franchise, and this really is the case this year.
Yeah, and it just seems like when has there been a lottery as important as this one? Like it feels like this one can't be screwed up just because. And obviously this is, you know, they have no control over this, but it feels like this is one of those. We just really need these lottery balls to fall into place because it just seems like such a critical draft here.
All right, so we got Pistons done. We got the Tigers done. Speaking of Tigers, it's now the bottom of the eighth. He's still dealing. Turnbull's still out there. He's still dealing. But let's get back to Lions now. So obviously we're kind of in that post-draft space with the Lions, where the news is going to be kind of thin and we're going to start clinging on to things that don't usually matter. But one thing that's always fun to have is the schedule. The schedule got released. It's a doozy for the Lions, I'd say. It's not an easy road. I believe there's only one primetime game, if I'm correct. Yeah, Monday night against the Packers.
And, I mean, if you count Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving, that's true. That's true. I always forget Thanksgiving. Yeah. Thanksgiving is against the Bears, so that's.
I think this is like our. What was it? I think this is the third time in the last 4 years we played the Bears on Thanksgiving.
Yep.
Terrible.
Yeah, no, I don't. I want the Vikings. I always like the Vikings matchup. That just seemed right. I don't know.
Vikings is always the most just palatable NFC North team to me, I guess.
I love it when they play Green Bay specifically. I know they always lose, but. It just seems right. Green Bay, Detroit, a fantastic NFC North rivalry are the best one you're going to get for Thanksgiving. I know the Packers-Bears is a little better, but what a boring schedule. One primetime game. I mean, it's more than they got last season, but poor Lions. They deserve it, but come on.
Yeah, and just to highlight a couple of this things in the schedule, kind of sucks for the Lions because I think they play some of the best divisions in the NFL. They play the NFC West this year, which genuinely you could make a case for every team making the playoffs. The AFC North, I mean, Cincinnati's the only, like, only slacker, the Browns, and the Steelers.
I'm not even ready to say that Cincinnati's going to place last.
No.
Because Cincinnati is, I mean, if they figure out their issues along the offensive line, I really do think they could be a team that shocks a lot of people. I'll be honest, that's my.
Is that a hot take? I don't like their defense
a little bit. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I don't know maybe enough about them, but I think that they have kind of the enough pieces in place that they could like kind of find their way to some more success than maybe other people are billing them for.
Well, Cincinnati has just so many offensive weapons. They have several wide receiver weapons. They have Mixon at running back. They have Bernard as their RB2. Giovanni Bernard is a solid RB2. And of course, Joe Burrow had that horrible injury last season, and his season a little early. If he comes back from that strong, this could be a very scary offense. That's the one thing the Bengals need to worry about is Burrow, because the rest of their offense is pretty much set. The offensive line and tight end scenarios aren't great, and their defense is hot garbage. So Lions probably beat them anyways.
Yeah, but more generally, though, the AFC North is just, like we were saying, a tough, tough division to pull. I mean, every single team this year, you can make a case for them being the Lions. And it is the Lions, so you can make a case for nearly any team to challenge them. But I was already pretty pessimistic going into this season. Like, just seeing, and the way it falls is not terrible. Like, it could be worse. I don't think there's any, like, especially horrific stretches. But it's definitely not. It's I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid after I've seen this schedule. I don't think anyone should be, really.
No, and it really sucks because they pulled like some unfortunate road games because they play the AFC North. But they'd much rather host Pittsburgh, a team that can just be meh, than say Baltimore. Now they host Baltimore because the Lions aren't going to win at Pittsburgh. They could beat them at Ford Field. They're not going to win there. In Baltimore, they're so talented. The Lions just can't beat them. The only way they can win a game against somebody in the AFC North is the Bengals. Then you go into the rest of their division. That's nonsense. And the AFC opponent at Denver. If they hosted Denver, that'd be a great game. But at Denver, that's just going to turn into a close game, probably a loss. So the road games they pulled, if they were at home and you flipped a couple of the other home games, that would likely be losses, say, like a Baltimore. They could be in the 7-8 win range. Now that seems like a huge long shot. That's not going to happen.
And the Denver game, I just wanted to point out really quickly, is at Mile High in December. So that's going to be a tough game regardless. Just based on the...
Especially if their starter is Aaron Rodgers.
God, I hope that happens so badly. Oh, my God.
I think things have kind of cooled down with that situation, though, it seems like. Unfortunately, it seems like it's kind of just... tampering down.
Who knows? Yeah, it'll be something interesting to still follow along with.
Is there only one preseason game this year?
No, there are three.
There are three.
So okay. There's just one last.
Oh, okay. Okay, yep. I got you.
And then the...
To make up for adding another game.
Yeah.
Which I don't love, I'll be honest. To kind of get into a different thing, I don't love the adding the extra game. I don't really understand it, but...
I don't love it, but I guess to me it's... I don't know.
Whatever. I just got a no-hitter alert from ESPN about Spencer Turnbull. Dude has pitched 8 innings without a hit. He has 1 walk so far.
3 outs away.
It's getting intense here.
Yeah. You know, I hate the 17-game schedule as well. I think it's absolutely stupid to have... half the teams playing 9 road games and 8 home games. It's just so unfair to those teams that are playing 9 road games, like the Lions. I know they'll have the advantage next year. I just don't like the odd number in sports. Games have to be even amount of numbers. You have to have the same amount of home games as you do road games. I would have preferred that they expanded it to 18 games, which is absurd. But that's what my preference would have been. 17 is just... there was absolutely no reason for it. There's no reason to expand the season. There's no reason to expand the playoffs to 7 teams per league. The system was right where it was. They could have decreased the preseason to 3 games. That was fine. No one watches preseason. The players hate it. They could have gone down to 3. The NFL is not caring about their players right now.
I was going to say, I think that's what I more care about. And to talk about like the sanctity of the game, I think a lot of it too has to do with like load management. I would hate for load management to become a part of the NFL. It's the reason I just can't watch the NBA regular season. At least I love the NBA playoffs. The NBA playoffs are fun, but I can't watch a regular season. If I'm going to tune into the Clippers and the Lakers, I want to see Kawhi play. You know, I want to see Leonard on the court, and he's just load management. It's just not fun to me, and that's kind of where the schedule is going. That's kind of, you know, it's a little annoying, but that's whatever. It's not really Lions specific, but it's a general gripe, I guess. But where do you guys kind of see this team projecting now after seeing, like, kind of how it goes out? What is, like, your win range, I guess?
I was going to say, do you want to do win range right now, or do you want to do our initial projections?
Let's go for initial projections.
Okay, I know that's what Paul wants to do.
Yes.
All right.
Paul's going through it right now. Let's see.
Okay. I mean, I have a number in my head. Do you want me to just
Go ahead. Go with yours.
Okay. So I'm gonna say 5-12. I don't know if this is a hot take at all, or if it's... I think it's probably a pretty lukewarm take. I think that's where a lot of fans are right now. But you know, obviously the schedule's hard. I think they have like the third hardest strength of schedule based on last year's records. Third hardest in the NFL. So, obviously they have their work cut out for them. I think I actually saw something interesting online, or in just an article or something. It was like, do you think this Lions roster is better than last year's? And my immediate like gut instinct was to say no, because of all the guys they lost on offense, and you know, they haven't really added that much on defense necessarily, or not a whole lot of like talent that'll like project as
immediate
starters, yeah, immediate impact, yeah. Yep. But then I don't know. I kind of thought about, like, if you take into account the coaching staff, though, because I think just based on the kind of change of scheme and some of that, I think that will literally, you know, that alone makes this roster better. So, like, that's kind of where I stand on it. I do believe that the coaching staff can kind of propel them to just more success than last year's team.
And we've already heard some telling quotes, especially from, like, the defense, mm-hmm. about, like, guys like Jeff Okuda saying, man, I wish I would have heard this last year. I wish I would have heard this in my rookie year. It's just so telling. It's such an indictment of the former, just of that organization before this. So I think you're right there. I think that – but to me, it kind of balances out because they lost so much to me, like, over the past couple of years, I guess I want to say more generally. Darius Slay, Kenny Galladay, guys like Golden Tate, some of those – you know, the past couple of years, I think they've been bleeding talent more than they've been gaining it.
And then obviously Stafford.
And then Staff. I mean, Staff gone. Mm. I don't care what you think about Goff, whether you think he's a good – he is a downgrade from Stafford. He is. But I think you're right. I think it's going to kind of balance out because of the way that it's just falling. I think, though, it kind of balances out. The coaching staff is good. The problem is this is a tough schedule. This is not a good schedule. So I have them at 4 wins. I have them 4-13. I don't see a lot of wins here. I don't see a lot of wins on the schedule. I see like a couple of home wins. Maybe they split the series with like the Bears. That's what I'm projecting. I think that's a.
And I think that one of the things that makes these projections the hardest is, in all honesty, the interdivision matchups are usually, I don't want to say a toss up, because obviously there are many times that Green Bay has an advantage over us or something like that. But I think that any NFC North game can be competitive. I'll say that.
Yeah, I think it's very unlikely that the Lions go 0-6 in divisional play just because the Bears and Vikings exist. But I have the Lions going 6-11, which they could do much worse. The thing is, I have them going 6-11, but their ceiling's 7-9 for me. I just don't see them doing much better. Like, they're going to be touching the ceiling for me at that mark. I have them beating the Bears at home. I have them beating Cincinnati at home. I have them beating Philly. I have them beating Atlanta. I have them beating Denver. Then I have them either winning at Chicago or getting one of the two games against Minnesota or one of the two games against Green Bay or San Francisco or Arizona. I have them winning one of those. Maybe two and dropping one of the five games that I mentioned. You know, and I think there are 10 or 11 possible wins on the schedule. Don't get me wrong. But they're not going to win more than 7 of those. And this team, they could go 0-17. Okay, I have them at 6 wins. But they literally could lose to anybody that they play. Don't let anybody tell you that there is a lock win on the schedule. Because it doesn't exist. There's not a lock win. Because the Lions are one of the worst talented teams in the NFL right now.
I mean, I agree that you can't lock in any single game into a win, but at the same time, like, I don't know. I think if you're a betting man, you don't bet on them. That kind of thing, 0-17 would just be something else.
That would be hilarious.
I don't think that's too...
No, I don't think it's likely. I may have him winning 6 games, but it can happen. Like, first year of a new regime, that stuff happens.
You're just kind of saying things, Paul. Like, yeah, it could happen. They could also go to the Super Bowl, technically. You're just saying things. So I don't know. They're not going to go 0-17, dude. They're just not. Like, if a team's going to go 0-17 this year, It's down south. It's the Texans, bro. Texans are terrible. They're in such a terrible situation. They're garbage. They had, what, like 2 picks this year? They were so bad.
Maybe Davis Mills moves the needle for them.
Oh, my God. I was so sad when he went there. I actually liked him as a prospect. I wanted to cheer for him because I saw him as an under-the-radar guy. Now he goes to the Texans. I don't want to cheer for him now. I hate the Texans.
I will say that I think the odds of the Lions going 0-17 are significantly higher than them of making the postseason because of where their ceiling is. But just such a hard schedule. There's nothing fun for the Lions on this thing. There's no optimism to be had.
Well, let's talk a little optimism real quick. So we have a new regime, and that's going to be the main storyline of the season, obviously. Is there a game that you kind of see where you're like, if they win it, if they pull it off, or if, you know, something like that happens, it'll kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say reassure, but kind of like confirm that this regime is heading in the right direction? Is there a win that you say, oh, like if they pull this off, I think this team is heading in the right direction?
There are several home games that I would just put on this list. Green Bay, Baltimore, Minnesota, Arizona, San Francisco. They're probably not going to win any of these games. They shouldn't. But if they can win one or two of these games and they don't lose to like Cincinnati to offset, because the Lions like to do that. They like to get a win that they shouldn't, but they'll offset it later by losing a game that they should have won. But if they can win those games that they should win and get one or two of these home wins, or even beat Green Bay or Minnesota or Chicago on the road, I would throw those in there. That would be very optimistic.
Well, yeah, you talk about kind of like what would maybe be like a defining win. And I mean, what better than Monday Night Football at Lambeau?
Yup, that was week 2. I had that circled. Yep.
That I think
that's a way to endear yourself to Lions fans too.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that would be. Now that could also be one of those, like, you know, Detroit Lions almost beating the Chiefs. What was it?
27-24.
Yeah.
Last year, because I remember. Was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay, because I remember watching it in my car when I was working. I went on lunch specifically timed so I could watch the end of it in my car. And I wanted to go drive my car off a bridge afterwards. I was so incredibly mad.
The thing is, what's so sad is that team 2 years ago before Stafford got injured was good enough to beat the Chiefs at home. They were. And that Chiefs team was not at their prime in that season. Before they won that Super Bowl, but they were good enough to beat that team before Stafford left. Shouldn't have, but they definitely were, and there's a lot of teams that were not.
Super quick update, Spencer Turnbull is now starting ninth inning in his no effort, so we will keep this, we will monitor this very closely as we continue our Lions talk. But
so if I'm looking, like, I'm a pretty tough guy to win over, especially when I start off not loving certain aspects of the staff. And it's such an unpopular opinion, but I don't love Dan Campbell as a head coach. I love him as a guy. I think he's fun. I've watched a few of his interviews. I love him as a guy, but as a leader of a football team, you know, I would like a little bit more experience calling X's and O's. I'm more of an Andy Reid type guy, where you're in the grid, in the, like, oh my God, you just got another one.
We are 2 outs away, ladies and gentlemen. 2
outs
Jesus
away. Holy my goodness. Lord. What? Oh my God. Watch him try and do like a slide into first, like the guy the Indians player did against that.
Oh wait, no.
Oh my God. Just a second, I need to watch. Okay, all right. Let's get back to. My bad. I'm getting so distracted. Mr. Turnbull, of all the Tigers to do it too, it's gonna be Turnbull. I'll take it. I mean, that's awesome. I love Turnbull, Big Red. But
yeah, I think it's hilarious.
Oh my God, Turnbull, beautiful. But getting back to Lions, I think obviously Packers is the number one win I want to see. But if they go into like, if they go like
Pittsburgh,
into Pittsburgh,
or I mean, L.A.
Oh my God! Would that not
talk,
be the
talk
best,
about a storyline or like a narrative?
Oh
pusher.
My God! That would the talking heads would go insane for that one, dude. They would love that.
What else? I mean, we talked about Denver. At Denver would be. I think that could be considered a statement win. I mean, even at Seattle, honestly.
Yeah. No, I could see that. Yeah, Seattle games are always kind of. Those ones are always odd to me. But I think that's.
I think that just about wraps up our scheduled talk.
Yeah. Yeah. What were we gonna do for the roundtable?
So we were gonna talk about the Detroit Lion rookie numbers that have been released. We've gone over a lot of stuff today, so I think a quick hitter,
a nice light one.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let me pull up these numbers. But yeah, we kind of heard about some of these through the rookie mini camp, you know, just from pictures and from the media was allowed to be at the rookie mini camps that just took place. So I have the list of all of the draft picks except for Sewell, because obviously I forget if we even talked about this, but he ended up missing the rookie mini camps because he tested positive for COVID. But anyways, so going down the list, so Levi Onwuzurike has been sporting number 75. Initial impressions?
I don't know. It doesn't fit him for some
reason. I don't like 75.
I don't like
75.
Much,
I'll be honest.
No.
I just don't like
sevens. I don't know. Like, I don't like seven as the first number.
Right.
I don't like the 70s. It's like, what? The only 70 I like is 71, Larkin.
I'm cool with 72 if it's like an offensive tackle.
No, I was thinking 72. I like 72, 76, 74, 75. That's like...
That is weird.
That's a money number. That's not really... That's not a jersey number. Come on.
Yeah, no, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. Oh my God, my thing froze. Brian, what's happening?
Here, you can take my phone for a second. Anyways, so moving on down, our other D lineman, Aleem McNeil, had been sporting number 54. How do we feel about 54?
Aleem McNeil, 54. I kind of like that one, you know.
I don't mind it. I think...
I've heard better numbers.
I remember I was listening to the their... live press conference after minicams, and somebody asked him, you know, like, what's the thought process behind 54, like what? And he was like, I was trying to get the lowest number that I could, because I think it was like in college or something, he wore like 26 or something weird
for a D lineman?
Like a nose tackle. I could be wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, yeah. So I think 54 is an interesting pick. I think it's like an unspectacular number. Like, it's just kind of, oh, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and so next, Fatu Melifonwu was wearing number 26.
I was hoping for a weirder number.
I like 26 weird, for running dude. Backs. I think 26 is a
yes.
good running back number.
Perfect running back
but,
number.
But that is the only position that 26 would be acceptable.
Dude, I like ones. I like 21. I don't know.
21 would have been a good, yeah. Although that's Tracy Walker.
You know, I like 26 for Matu Felimano.
For who, Paul?
I'm not going to repeat it. But that just seems like his number. I really like it. I don't know.
All right. Okay, so let's move on to our next one. So Amon-Ra St. Brown, receiver out of USC, was wearing number 14. Yeah, I agree, Paul. I'm not a huge fan of 14 for a wide receiver.
Oh,
I don't
that's
know.
His na- I don't like that at all.
Man, we have not been very high on these numbers so far. But I think, I don't know. Dude, I guess it's fine just because he's like a slot receiver. Like, if it's going to be
okay,
a receiver,
okay,
it has to
be
a slot receiver at 14.
Okay, I see that then.
Okay, next up, Derek Barnes, linebacker, wearing number 55. That's a pretty classic linebacker number.
I like that. I got to give a quick update, though. Literally two outs and an error on first got, like, Miggy. It was a walk? No, I don't think it was.
It was.
It says no hitter through. Was it? Okay.
All right. Oh, wait. So the no-hitter is still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul says yes.
It was a walk?
Yeah.
Then why did he hit it? I don't think okay. That's true, Paul.
While Alex and Paul are figuring this out, I will move on. Or I guess I don't really have much more to say about Derek Barnes at 55.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense,
I think
sense,
it just
though.
Makes sense. And then, so the last one, their running back, Jamar Jefferson, is number 28. This one I like. I like 28 for a running back.
28's legit. I like that. I feel like that looks good.
Mm-hmm. I think Jefferson 28 will be a good good pairing.
Oh,
on the
I
back
forgot
of
that
his
he's
jersey.
The best name too. Yeah. Jamar Jefferson 28. Oh, yeah. I think Paul's right actually. Oh, he got the no hitter, dude.
Did he really?
Yes. No way.
No kidding. Ladies
Spencer
and gentlemen,
Turnbull, dude.
We are recording history
what?
Right now. Spencer Turnbull.
What?
This just in.
Dude, no way! Spencer Turnbull!
Oh
goodness. My god!
I don't have anything else to say about the Lions rookie or jersey numbers. I'm in disbelief right now.
Big Red got a no-hitter, dude. What is up this
Paul, initial reactions, initial impressions.
I think this is the first Tigers no-hitter since Verlander's in 2012. I want to say it is.
I think you're right. Because they were showing, like, during the beginning of the broadcast, they were showing, or not the beginning, but I think it was, like, in the fifth inning when he kind of had something going. They were showing just a Verlander clip.
It just came up.
Yep.
First no-hitter since 2011.
Let's go, baby.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's the first non-Verlander no-hitter from the Tigers since pre-06. So it's nice to see a new name here. It's been probably over 20 years since they've had somebody not named Justin Verlander throw a no-hitter. This isn't common, folks. I mean, this year there's been several no-hitters. But it's great to see
this,
the
this has been
it.
So strange.
Yeah.
Dude, Spencer
this
Turnbull
is like
has
the
just...
sixth one. What?
That's hilarious that it's Spencer
Dude,
Turnbull.
Dude, that is – if there was one guy I could have picked – I love Turnbull. I mean, Mize is pretty sick as well, but I love Turnbull. I love Turnbull so much. Big Red out on the mound. He's oh, my God. That just makes my night. That makes my week, dude.
Oh, and the Tigers did win this game. So they are now 16-26, and they have won 2 out of 3 against Seattle. Things are looking up. When you don't give up hits, you don't lose.
Yo, I just got the ESPN breaking news notification. I think that's the first breaking news I've gotten about a Detroit team that hasn't made me want to hit my head against a concrete wall. Good Lord. Well, I think that's a perfect way to wrap the episode there. I think...
Absolutely.
I don't think there's a better way to end it there. Spencer Turnbull, no-hitter. Follow us on Twitter, at Motown Redcast, and just go out and celebrate this. Go and celebrate Big Red getting a no-hitter, his first of his career.
I think really quickly we should all plug our own personal Twitters again, just because we haven't done that since the first episode.
Yeah, good idea.
So for me, you can follow me at... Ryan Caloris on Twitter. That's RyanColores. There you can find some of my tweets. Some of them are about CMU. Some of them are about I don't know. A lot of
it's an eclectic mix.
Just a lot of Lions, a lot of Pistons. Kind of what you might expect. But
yeah, mine is @Paul_Kissell. KISELL.
And on Paul's, you'll see lists about anything from SpongeBob to cartoons to Disney movies or Star Wars. He ranks Star Wars movies too sometimes.
He also makes sure to retweet that Give It Up for Day 15 post every single 15th of every month. He makes it a point to do that. So
I didn't know he did that.
Yeah.
Don't follow him. All right. Mine is @AlexPickFaber. It's Pick Faber because I forgot the E in Epic, so I don't know what's more embarrassing.
Wait, what year is your Twitter from? What year did you make it?
Bro, I mean, not long enough to go where that makes sense. Not long enough for that, like, I can reasonably write that off. Let me see, because it says it on there.
I know,
right?
My Twitter's from 2014, but I'm sure that...
2015, bro. That's okay. I was too old. I guess I was a freshman in high school, but still.
I'll give you a pass
so
on that.
So, Alex Pickfaber, I'll be honest, it's a lot of Red Wing stuff, because I write for Octopus Thrower, and I do a lot of, like, retweeting there and all that. But yeah, go ahead and follow us all. Like I said, go celebrate the no-hitter. Follow us on Twitter. We tweet all our new information there and everything. But yeah, thanks for listening, guys.